Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking with Henry Petroski. He is a professor of civil engineering at Duke University, where his special area of interest and focus is failure analysis. He's also professor of history at Duke, and probably to the general population, is better known for having written about the history of everyday devices, simple things that we may well use on a daily basis and yet not think about very much. We'll be talking about his most recent book today, and he explains that it came about as he was looking for something to illustrate some basic principles of engineering that would, at the same time, say something about the relationships between technology and culture. And he settled on the simplest of manufactured things. It consists of a single part intended for a single purpose, made out of a single material from which it gets its simple name. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking about the history, the evolution, the development of the toothpick. And that is indeed the title of Henry Petroski's most recent book, The Toothpick, Technology and Culture. It is published by Knopf, and you can certainly find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. As I mentioned, Henry Petroski is professor of civil engineering and history at Duke. He has written more than a dozen books, and a number of them, including The Evolution of Useful Things, Paperboy, Remaking the World, Small Things Considered, and To Engineer, and also The Pencil. All of these books are available in paper, most of them published by Vintage, and The Pencil is published by Knopf. And the new book is out now, and we're pleased that he could spend a little time talking with us. Questions are certainly welcome. If people want to be involved in this conversation, you may do that. You're welcome to do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line if it would be a long-distance call for you. So if you're listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana, if you're listening on the Internet, you can use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you want to be part of the show, you can certainly give us a call. Professor Petroski, hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Good.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. I think that you explain in the preface that you have never been a regular user of toothpicks for their major intended purpose, I guess. Although, like a lot of people, and I'm sure that this is an accurate description of our house as well, that probably in everybody's house, in a cupboard, in a drawer somewhere, there is a box of toothpicks, as you describe it, in a faded and tattered pasteboard box in a dark corner of a kitchen cupboard. Yeah, probably everybody can say, oh, yes, we have some. So having said that it is something that we might find almost in every house and not think very much about until maybe the time that you need one, what led you to decide that you wanted to devote an entire book to this very simple thing?
Well, as you indicated, I was looking for a simplest manufactured object to illustrate some ideas about engineering and design, and the toothpick did come to mind. I was originally going to write a chapter on it in another book of mine called Success Through Failure, but when I tried to find a little bit of history to put the toothpick in context, I had a very difficult time. Using the Internet was very frustrating because I had all sorts of contradictory information that I could look up, and I had no real way of deciding which was right and which was wrong. So I put the idea aside, but I had a nagging feeling that there might be a very interesting story behind this, at least behind why it's such a confused history on the Internet. Mm. And you can't get a book about it, so I thought, well, maybe there is a book here that I could write. And the more I got into it, the more I believed that was indeed the case. I happened to spend my summers in Maine, where I also do most of my writing, including this book, and Maine was producing 95% of all wooden toothpicks made at one time. And today, there are no toothpicks made in Maine, and it's largely because of a familiar problem, namely Chinese imports. So that added another dimension to it. It made the toothpick story, the manufacturing of toothpicks and the industry, really representative of a lot of the manufacturing issues that are happening in the world today.
Yeah, globalization has hit the toothpick just like it's hit just about everything else.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that it may well be that the toothpick is one of the oldest manufactured devices that people have used. At least if you look at the fossil record, there is good reason to believe that going back a long way in human history, that people were using toothpicks.
Well, that's right. Anthropologists have found fossilized teeth that are almost 2 million years old that have strange grooves on them. And these grooves are inexplicable unless they assume that there were some kind of continued and frequent toothpick use, not the kind of toothpicks we might, you know, buy today, but primitive ones that were just found, pieces of grass, for example, that have rough particles in them to grind and erode the teeth. One anthropologist got the idea that that might indeed be what caused the grooves. So she got some actual teeth and used some actual grass and just worked the teeth for hours and hours and days on end and found that she could indeed create the similar grooves. So she felt that she confirmed her hypothesis that that was what people really were doing and that was why the grooves were there.
Mm. Well, we can talk about the vast range of natural things that people have used, but certainly we also know that there is a long history to the toothpick because going back to the ancient world, we actually have examples, things that people, metal ones, made perhaps of other material. So indeed, we know that these were devices that have been around. People have been making them and using them for a long time, and we actually have very old examples of them.
Well, that's right. Back in ancient times, the toothbrush, as we know it at least, didn't exist, and those that did exist were not very effective. So the toothpick was really the principal form of dental hygiene, and it was very, very important. And people had their personal toothpicks that were, and if you could afford it, that would be made of gold or silver, and you carried that around and you used it. And often you used it in public. The idea of not using a toothpick as a matter of etiquette is a modern idea.
People apparently have used all kinds of natural things, things that came to hand, mm-hmm. and you can imagine that people did. It may well have used a little piece of wood, which is essentially what a toothpick is, but a lot of other natural things as well, things that you would find in the environment, and certainly people, they obviously felt they had the need. They had this task that needed to be accomplished, and they looked around and thought, well, now, what have I got around here that will actually be good for that? What are some of the things that we know that people have actually used as toothpicks?
Well, there's one thing that I find interesting. And back in the 1960s, when they still served meals on planes, an Alaskan airline gave out complimentary toothpicks, and they were mounted on a card that identified them as walrus whiskers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were advertised as lifetime toothpicks. And in fact, these were used by people around the world. And the Alaskans actually exported them to China and everywhere else. When the whiskers dried, they were pretty stiff, and they had a point, but not too sharp a point. And they made an ideal toothpick.
And here, in fact, there's a picture of one here in the book that I guess you... You actually bought yourself on eBay?
Yes, eBay proved to be a very good resource. There are a lot of things offered on eBay that I don't know that I would have come across or even known about by any other means. And generally speaking, there aren't a lot of people bidding for toothpicks. So it wasn't... I didn't need to make a big capital investment. But such things as that walrus toothpick and the card that, you know, it's mounted on, mm-hmm. Contains information that is rather objective. Now, there are a lot of things on eBay that you have to be careful about. Those people selling things will often make statements and claims that are simply not true. There was one box of toothpicks that was offered on eBay that was claimed to be a Civil War era box, and from what I know through the patent literature and so forth, the machinery to make toothpicks just didn't exist in the Civil War, during the Civil War. So that was an overstatement. But I bought them, and I was very glad I did, and I was able to date them probably in the 1870s, so pretty close, but still a very interesting set of objects, not only the toothpicks in the box, which showed me how things were made back then, the products of the manufacturing process, but also the box itself and the label on it contained invaluable information.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Henry Petrosky. He is professor of civil engineering and of history at Duke University and has written a number of books, some of them having to do with the evolution and the development of everyday devices, things that we use in our daily lives and perhaps don't think very much about. And it is the case that that's the subject of his most recent book. The title is The Toothpick, and it is all about the development of this device, which actually goes back a long way in human history. It's published by Knopf. It's out now. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, sticking with this theme of naturally occurring things that people have turned to for this use, the first really mass-produced toothpick, I think, or maybe I haven't got this right, you can correct me, it was in fact made out of a quill.
Yes, goose quills.
Goose quill.
Mm-hmm. Yes, back in the 19th century, first part of the 19th century, goose quills were generally used as pens to write, you know, the famous quill, the familiar quill, the feathered pen. But then the steel pen nib was invented and was a big hit because it was much more durable. It didn't have to be constantly sharpened and pointed. So those who raised geese for quill pens suddenly found themselves with a lot of geese and a lot of feathers, but without a product to sell in the same quantities that they were used to. So they began to manufacture goose quill toothpicks in rather large quantities, and they were very successful. This was when the wooden toothpick was really very, very young and was not as widely distributed. The goose quill is a very good toothpick. A lot of people favored it, but it had one big problem, and that was it didn't have a long shelf life. It dried out and cracked and splintered and so forth. Whereas toothpicks, as I mentioned, you know, you can find a box from over 100 years ago, and they're still good and usable. Hmm. I was in Scotland last summer and was in a very small town in northern Scotland in a small hotel with a small dining room. And as is the case in Europe generally, there were toothpicks on the table. They were wrapped up, and they often are these days for sanitary reasons. Well, I took a handful of them when I left the restaurant, and later when I opened up one of them, I was surprised that it was actually a quill toothpick. It wasn't a wooden toothpick. Now, it happened to be made out of plastic. Generally speaking, the quills that you can buy today or find today are made of plastic, which is considered actually an improvement over the natural ones.
How did they deal with the hygiene issue here? Because I would think that people would be maybe just a little reticent about sticking something in their mouth that had been plucked off of a bird like that. How did they clean them?
Well, they clean them by swishing them around in you know, some kind of cleansing agent. But you're right, there still was the skepticism of a lot of people. The companies handled this in part by advertising that the toothpicks were hygienic, often naming their company Hygienic or Hygiene or something to suggest a hygienic product. This was not only the case with the quill toothpicks, but even with the wooden toothpicks. There was concern about, well, who's packing these things? How many people are touching them before they get to my mouth? So a lot of the toothpick companies began to label their boxes, put on their boxes, never touched by human hand. Basically, they were saying that the tree comes in, it's put in the machinery, and everything is sort of automatic from then. And the boxes came sealed, and this was a big selling point. Today, of course, we see principally in restaurants that the toothpicks are wrapped. They usually are wrapped in transparent cellophane, but like the ones I got in Scotland, sometimes they're wrapped in opaque paper, sometimes with the restaurant's name stamped on it, and there they often make a statement that it's hygienic, in addition to just the signal that you get from the wrapping.
We have a caller. Why don't we bring them in to the conversation? In Belgium, not all that far away from us, over by Danville, this is line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Mr. Inge, you're probably aware of the question I'm going to ask is, how do you make these things? There's flat ones and there's round ones. Obviously, the flat ones could be split and ribbed out of the wood so that you don't lose too much because of the saw. But the ones that really I question about is, how do you get those nice round ones with tapered points? And every one of them are exactly the same.
That's a very good question. And I spend a lot of time in the book, actually, with descriptions of how that's done. The book is both a technical history of the manufacture of toothpicks and a cultural history of their use. Back in the 1860s, there was a man named Charles Forster who acquired the rights to a patent for the manufacture of toothpicks. Patent basically described the process whereby you take a log and you peel it around in a spiral so that you basically have a veneer, a very thin veneer. And then you feed this veneer into another machine that punches out the toothpick. So it's almost like a cookie-cutting process. And there was actually very little waste associated with this because the whole toothpick basically the whole stamping was the toothpick. There was only some loss in beveling the edges to make the points. That's what we would today call a flat toothpick, and basically flat toothpicks are still made by that process or something very, very similar. The round toothpick is a very interesting story because that obviously takes a lot more figuring out. A patent, of course, gives you a monopoly. So this Charles Forster had a monopoly on making these flat toothpicks by that process, but then all patents expire and the monopoly runs out. But he, anticipating that, started doing research on a way of making round toothpicks. He thought he could get a new patent and therefore a new monopoly. That happened in the late 1880s, roughly. And the way that was done was basically starting with a flat toothpick, or really a blank for a flat toothpick, something like a matchstick, which matchsticks were made in a very similar way, and then putting it into a machine that basically ground it in an annular space between two cylinders that were roughened with sawdust, silica and other hard particles. And out the other end came this round toothpick. Basically, it was just shaped. The patent called it a compressing process. It was pushed into a round shape from effectively a square shape. And he patented that. It was a very, very beautiful toothpick because of the process. The manufacturing process is what you know gives something its shape. And it was a very organic shape. It tapered ever so gradually from the center to the points, and that was because of the way it was made. Round toothpicks today, if you look at them, tend to be not so graceful in their shape, in my opinion. They are basically like a dowel that is just sharpened at each end, like a pencil might be. There's also another kind of toothpick that's called square round, and these were introduced in the 1980s, and here the center of the toothpick is left square, and only the ends are sharpened. And these have been advertised by the manufacturers as improvements, but from an aesthetic point of view, I think they are actually a regression because they just don't look as pretty. The way round toothpicks are made today, there are several processes, and generally they are more like making dowels, or even making pencils, where you round them and then you sharpen the end.
Seems you'd have a lot more waste that way.
That's right. Well, waste has always been a problem in the manufacturing process, and that was a problem from the beginning. But the manufacturers were rather clever. They took all that waste and they generated energy from it. They would burn it to generate steam, and then run their machines. So although it was waste on one level, it was not that bad on another level.
Yeah, very much like a sawmill today.
Yeah.
They do, or used to. They don't do it so much today, I guess. To some extent they do. But yes, they used to turn their waste into fuel.
Mm-hmm.
The process you were talking about, it goes just through a couple of cylinders, and they are abrasive, or they're just compressive?
Yes, they're abrasive and compressive.
Oh, both.
As this little splint progresses through, the space becomes increasingly constricted. So it's compressing them and abrading them.
Both at the same time.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about Charles Forster, the man who was the first magnate of toothpick manufacturing in the United States, I guess, and how it is that he got this idea to turn this into a mass-produced product in the United States.
Well, he was born in the Boston area, and one of his uncles ran an import-export business and had an office in Brazil that Charles Forster went down to work in. While Forster was in Brazil, he noticed that the natives had very, very white teeth. They were clean and cavity-free. And he noticed that they used these toothpicks, wooden toothpicks, which Forster was not very familiar with. And he got the idea that, and this was the 1850s, 1860s, at that time, just about anything that could be made by machine was being made by machine, or machines were being invented and developed to make things that had before then been made by hand, pretty much. So Forster's idea was that he would go back to Boston and make toothpicks by machine and make them so efficiently that he would be able to export them to Brazil and, you know, sell them for a price under what it would cost for the handmade ones that were being used down there. He went back to Boston and developed the machinery, which, as I mentioned earlier, was actually invented by someone else,
mm-hmm.
a gentleman named Benjamin Franklin Sturtevant. But Sturtevant wasn't interested in making toothpicks. He thought he could make a lot more money making other things. So he would sell the rights to his patents in order to get money to continue his own development work. So when Forster acquired the rights to this patent, then he had to perfect the process, basically. And he spent close to 10 years doing that. Among the problems were, what kind of wood do you use? What's the best wood to make a toothpick? And he had to experiment with a lot of different woods. Some woods were too hard, and they dull the knives very quickly, and that would, you know, make the process much more expensive. Other woods had a lot of sap, and they gummed up the works and so forth and so on. Eventually, he found that white birch was the best wood. It was, you know, a compromise of everything else. And he also realized that white birch didn't grow around the Boston area. It grew in Maine. So that's when he moved his operation up to Maine. This was about 1870. And that's why the toothpick industry became established in Maine. Forster went on to live up to everything he promised. He began making toothpicks that were exported around the world. By the time he died in 1901, he had a very thriving business. He was very wealthy by the standards of the day. And he left a business that continued for over a century.
Let me very quickly introduce again the guest for anyone who might have tuned in Over the last 10 or 15 minutes, Henry Petrosky is professor of civil engineering and also professor of history at Duke University, and has written a number of books and is known certainly as someone who has written a lot about everyday devices. The pencil, for example, one of his books that's now available in paperback. He's also has written a new book that's just out. It's titled The Toothpick, Technology and Culture is the subtitle. It's published by Knopf, and you can find it in the bookstore, I'm sure. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. You told the story about how it was that Charles Forster had this idea to manufacture wooden toothpicks and then to be able to export them throughout the world, and that in fact that he was not the one who originally developed the machine. This was this man Benjamin Franklin Sturtevant, and the interesting part of the story here is that it's an example of how something that was originally designed to manufacture one kind of thing, that technology was taken and adapted to manufacture something else. And here is the interesting and unusual connection between shoes and how they were made at this time and the toothpick.
Yes, that's right. In the middle of the 19th century, shoes were not made quite the way we see them made today. Typically, a shoe, other than a running shoe or something like that, would be sewn if it had a leather sole, let's say. So the leather sole would be sewn to the uppers, which would also be leather. That would be the typical shoe in the middle of the 20th century, let's say. Well, in the middle of the 19th century, sewing was not used, in part because the thread was hard to pull through the leather, and also in part because the thread would actually rot and shoe would fall apart. So what was used for a large number of the shoes, as many as 80% in some kinds of shoes, were wooden pegs. There would be a hole pushed through the leather to be attached, pieces of leather to be attached using an awl, and then a little wooden peg, like a little nail except wood, would be pounded into that hole. The idea would be that if the wood got wet, and there was a lot of mud and all in those days, you had to walk through. There weren't concrete sidewalks, for example. The wood would expand and actually hold even more tenaciously. Mm-hmm. So it was a very good way of making shoes, but it was very time-consuming to make them that way. Pounding each of these individual pegs all around the shoe, and sometimes in two rows to be doubly effective. So Benjamin Franklin Sturtevant, who was a shoemaker, or apprenticed to be one, knew how tedious this was, and he wanted to develop a machine to drive these pegs automatically. And a lot of people were trying to do this at the same time. The fact is that he found that no matter how well he made his machine, there was a weak link in the process, and that was these wooden pegs. Wooden pegs were sometimes made by hand by people in, after hours they'd sit in their cottage and just whittle these pegs and then sell them to a shoemaker. Or there were other processes for making them, but they were irregular. You couldn't count on one being like the last. And as a result, these pegs either gummed up the machine or messed up the machine because they split regularly along the grain, or they were either too small or too large, and they'd sometimes ruin the leather. So Sturtevant began to concentrate on making the pegs themselves, and he came up with this idea that you would take a log, you would smooth it off, take all the bark off, and you'd have then a cylinder. He put that on a lathe, and he'd have a knife that he would use to cut off a veneer from that log as it rotated around the lathe. And you can't just do this with any knife because the veneer will crack and it'll all fall apart, and it doesn't help. But he devised a special process whereby he could do this, and he could end up with a strip of veneer 100 feet long that was very uniform in thickness. And then what he did is he took one edge of that veneer. The width of that veneer was the length of a shoe peg. And he took that veneer strip and he beveled it on one edge. And then when he would stamp out an end of that veneer, he would have a shoe peg that had a point, and it was a very predictable length and width. And this basically is how Sturtevant made his first fortune. He was able to supply very high-quality pegwood, they called it. That was the term used for this veneer that shoemakers then could feed into their machines and have a very reliable operation.
And just one other part of the story, too. You talked with the previous caller about the fact that indeed Forster and this man Sturtevant, and there was another person who was important here, took the machine that Sturtevant had invented essentially to make the pegs for the shoes and retooled that to do something very similar that ended up with the flat toothpick, and that after that was patented, and then after that patent ran out, Forster was thinking, well, we got to have something that we can do that we can repatent, and he said, well, maybe we could do a round toothpick, and indeed developed a way to do the round toothpick. But when they went to the patent office, the patent office said, well, no, we don't think you should be able to patent this round toothpick, because they said, well, anybody could take a flat toothpick and just do a little work on there and make it into a round toothpick. It was apparently they didn't think that it was sufficiently different or sufficient improvement over what had gone before so that it would be patentable as a new product. How did they – and they did eventually manage to persuade the patent office to give them a patent on the process for manufacturing the round toothpick. How did they, though, persuade the patent office that it was sufficiently different so that it should be patentable?
Right. Well, Charles Forster had a principal mechanic named Charles Freeman working for him. And it was Freeman who was the mechanical brains of the operation. And it was Freeman who applied for this patent. Patents can only be applied for by the inventor, not by the inventor's boss, for example. So Freeman was trying to get this patented, and then he'd assign the rights to Forster, the company. But as you indicated, the patent office said, well, this is not something that we consider patentable. But what Freeman did is he, through his attorney, wrote a letter back to the patent examiner saying, well, look, it's true that anybody can whittle a piece of wood and make a point on a toothpick and make it round. But in the process of doing so, you cut through the fibers of the wood. And as a result, there are a lot of potential splinters around this point. Toothpick point. My process, he argued in this letter, doesn't cut any of the fibers. It compresses them. So all of the fibers surrounding the point of a toothpick are don't have any loose ends that can be potential splinters. And nobody wants a toothpick that is full of splinters. Well, that was very convincing. And the patent examiner then said, well, provide me with a model. At that time, the patent office, well, still, in fact, the patent office can demand a model be produced. So since Freeman was already in the development process, he had toothpicks that he had made by this procedure, and he just sent some of them to the patent examiner, and the patent examiner accepted that this was, in fact, a very patentable idea. Mm-hmm. The patent drawing for that concept is very interesting and if not unique. There's a typical patent in those days had a front page that had a drawing, had a series of drawings of the object that was being patented or the machine. In this case, it's a lot of white space, and there's this small little drawing of this round toothpick, and I consider it a minimalist patent drawing.
Once the man here, Charles Forster, had a way to mass produce toothpicks. So he had a way to produce them in very large volume. Then he had to start thinking about how it was he was going to market them. Making lots and lots of these toothpicks is one thing. Getting people to buy them is something else. And apparently he was wise enough to think that the way that he was going to make his money was by selling in volume. And that by selling to an individual household, if you sold everyone a box of toothpicks, he was wise enough to realize that wasn't going to get him where he wanted to go. The thing that would get him where he wanted to go was that if he could sell to institutional outlets, things like hotels and restaurants, if he could sell them not just one box of toothpicks, but boxes and boxes and boxes of toothpicks, he figured that's where the money was going to be. And so here he also faced the challenge of trying to develop a market to persuade in those kinds of buyers that they should indeed buy cases and cases of his toothpicks. How did he go about trying to build some demand for this product once he had figured out how to make it?
Yes, well, that's a good question. He did find himself with more toothpicks than he could sell because it was a new product, this idea of paying money for a piece of wood that you were going to throw away when you could just, you know, whittle a piece yourself. At the time, restaurants were not accustomed to giving out toothpicks. People had their own, as we talked about earlier. People would carry their ivory or bone or brass or gold toothpick around with them and reuse it. But Forster came up with this scheme. He hired some students from Harvard to go and eat at a restaurant, and the bill would be paid for by Forster, of course. And he said to the students, now, after you finish your meal, you ask for and demand wooden toothpicks. And when they did, the restaurant manager, of course, said, well, we don't have wooden toothpicks. And the students would raise a fuss and loudly announce that they expected to be provided with toothpicks after a meal that they were paying for, and that they were not going to frequent that place anymore. Well, of course, the next day, Charles Forster would show up peddling his toothpicks, and the restaurant manager was already marked to buy them. Well, this then introduced toothpicks into restaurants, and of course, competing restaurants had to also stock the toothpicks that came to be expected, and it became very fashionable for people of some means, actually. These are the people, after all, that would be eating in better restaurants, to, after a meal, take a wooden toothpick, and after using it for whatever we, would use it for, leave it in their mouth and chew it, walk around to announce that they had just had a good meal, stand in front of the restaurant or the hotel, chewing the toothpick, and as a means of just passing the time. And this became rather fashionable in the 1870s and 1880s. And women even began to pick up the habit. And there were a lot of editorials in newspapers denouncing this. But there were so many people doing it that it became faddish. It became fashion. And it took quite a while for it to come to this case we have in this country now, where it's associated not with having a good meal, but with having poor manners to walk around with a toothpick in your mouth.
I think that's fascinating that such a thing would turn around from being something that would be a sign of sophistication to a sign of lack of sophistication.
Mm-hmm. Well, wooden toothpicks were very cheap to buy. You could buy a whole box for a nickel, let's say, hundreds of them for a nickel. So eventually, everybody could afford them. And, of course, what happens is people that have lesser means try to emulate people with greater means, whatever's in fashion. But then whatever becomes fashionable to so many ceases to become, on the cutting edge of fashion. And the people that like to consider themselves, say, trendsetters or fashion mavens, then look for other things, to do to distinguish themselves. Hmm.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I'd like again to introduce the guest, Henry Petrosky. He's professor of civil engineering and professor of history at Duke University. And if you would like to read the book that we're talking about, the title is The Toothpick, and it's recently published by Knopf. His other books are also available, many of them in paper. You might also find his book, The Pencil, interesting. That's published by Knopf and is now available in paper. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800 1-800-222-9455. Here, this seems to be the case where the device, the very simplest, most straightforward design is also the one that accomplishes the basic task. So having seen a toothpick, I'm not sure that one could imagine that you could improve on it by somehow making it different, in a different shape or something like that, for example. But having said that, have there been other people who, as a mass-produced item, have looked at the toothpick and thought, I can improve this by changing the design of it somehow?
Oh, yes. That's what inventors are all about. They see in the simplest things, what we generally would consider perfected things, they see room for improvement. No design, nothing made, is perfect. It usually involves compromise and various limitations that might be inherent in the design. So there's always a way to improve on something, or at least to make the argument that you're improving upon it. But, of course, whatever you come up with as an improvement is going to have the same limitations. There will be also different compromises. So it's a never-ending process. But inventors, typically, if you read a patent, the inventor will begin by pointing out the shortcomings of what he or she is trying to improve upon. So it's very much a game of improvement. In the case of the toothpick, the flat toothpick, for example, you could say it had one of the problems that it had was that it was very flexible. Well, you couldn't make it too bulky, or it would not be well pointed. So the round toothpick produced basically a stiffer and stronger toothpick, if you will, a very subtle difference, and one that most people that use the toothpicks would not have noticed or really talked about. You. Users of objects, of things, of designs, generally adapt to them and adapt to their weaknesses or their flaws. If the toothpick is flexible and easily broken, well, you just don't work it as hard. You learn to do that. If you take a mechanical pencil, for example, with this very thin lead, it's very easily broken if you press too hard. But we learn rather quickly. That we don't press hard. We understand how much pressure is enough, so we don't constantly break the lead and have to project further pieces of lead out. People are very adaptable, and I take this as an indication that technology doesn't control us. We really adapt to technology not as a means of conforming to it, but rather as a means of conquering it, if you will.
Let's talk with some other people here who are listening. We have someone on a cell phone on our line number one. They're first in line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was actually just curious about when flavored toothpicks were introduced.
Excuse me, what toothpicks?
Toothpicks with flavoring.
Oh, flavoring, yeah. Oh, that goes back quite a ways, 100 years or so. It was early on an idea that seemed natural to some people. They would soak them in cinnamon or peppermint, all sorts of things. There were patents taken out for that too.
Well, that's a very interesting topic, actually. I'm glad you covered it. Thank you.
All right, okay. Very good. Let's go on. We'll talk next with someone in Robinson on our toll-free line. This is line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask your guest if he has additionally tried to find out when the first commercially made toothpick holders were produced.
Toothpick holders, that's a good question. In Spanish cultures especially, the use of toothpicks goes back centuries. And it was very common to, in a Spanish household, let's say, to have on the table a toothpick holder, because after the meal it was passed around and people would use the toothpicks openly at the table. And there are lots of reports of visitors to Spain or Portugal or Brazil who experienced this even centuries ago. And they found it, if they came from America where this was not done, they found it remarkable and therefore wrote about it. So the idea of holders goes back a long way. I don't think it can be dated precisely, but in America, toothpick holders didn't become introduced until late Victorian era, late 19th century, when these wooden toothpicks became so popular and they became accepted that then the next step was to set them out on a table either for people to use or to use to pick up hors d'oeuvres, and a holder was very commonly used for those purposes.
That confirms my intuition. Good. I have one family heirloom in a pattern glass called Dewey, which of course came out in 1898 in the Spanish-American War.
Uh-huh.
The familiar urn-shaped glass, usually colored ones, are quite common.
Uh-huh.
But
yes.
I also own one which is rather rare. It's a miniature porcupine done in pewter, and the porcupine has holes all over its body, and you filled the holes with loose toothpicks so it looked like a porcupine with an erect back. And people, of course, withdrew one from the hole as they needed it.
Yes, that was a common design. There is a society of toothpick holder collectors, and they issue a newsletter monthly, and they write about such things, and they're very... it's very interesting reading to me.
Well, good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And let us continue here. And next we'll talk with someone in Rend Lake. This is line two. Hello.
Yes. I had a comment for the good professor in that I bought a copy of the pencil book when it first came out because I had some interest in pencil sharpeners. And he has... provided me an opportunity to do a tremendous amount of research, including finding about 1,600 different patents for pencil sharpeners, and also purchasing pencils that I never thought I would ever purchase because of the book. And so I want to thank you for that. And I also want to know if you're going to write a book on the pencil sharpener, because there is a chapter in your pencil book.
Well, I thank you very much for your compliments. I do have a chapter in the book on pencil sharpeners, and that's probably where I will stop my research, because I found since writing the book that there are people like you who no doubt know a lot more than I ever will about pencil sharpeners.
Well, thank you very much, and very enjoyable program.
All right. Well, thank you. We have maybe about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus with our guest, Henry Petrosky. If you have a question, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I talked a little bit earlier about the idea that even though it's a simple device and the straightforward design seems to be perfectly fine for accomplishing the purpose, that people have continued to come along and tried to improve on the design. With different kinds of ideas. And I guess one of the ones that I really find fascinating, and I don't know if it's going too far as to say that it's culturally revealing or not, but is the Japanese toothpick. And perhaps you could describe that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the Japanese toothpick is very interesting. Japanese people find it curious that American toothpicks have two points, one on either end. The Japanese toothpick has a single point, and the other end is blunt, or it might look like it's decorated. It usually has grooves encircling the unpointed end. Those are not mere decoration. The practice in Japan is that when one uses a toothpick, and typically it would be used at a table where there are other people around, it would not be polite to use that toothpick and then put it down on the tablecloth. So the end that is not pointed can be broken off, and the grooves make it easy to break it off. And that little end then is put down on the table, and the point of the toothpick is rested on that. So it's sort of like a knife rest or a chopstick rest, mm-hmm. to keep the dirty ends off the tablecloth, and therefore not insult your fellow diners. The Japanese toothpick... It has become increasingly popular in the United States. I don't know if this practice has become increasingly popular because not everybody knows about it. They think these encirclements are merely for decoration.
Well, that was what I thought too. As I'm sure I know I have seen these types of toothpicks, and they almost the end is turned. It almost looks as if they had put it on a tiny lathe,
yes.
and turned those grooves in there. And I suppose I thought that same thing, that it was just that they thought that made it more attractive somehow. I had no idea that there was a purpose, and that indeed was the idea that you were supposed to. It's designed so that you would break it off and lay the toothpick down there so that the business end doesn't come in contact with the top of the table.
Even if you don't use the end that way, breaking off the end of the toothpick indicates that it's been used, which is another nice thing about the Japanese use of the toothpicks. You wouldn't want somebody to inadvertently pick up a toothpick that you had used. This breaking it indicates that.
It's a remarkable subject, and there is even more. There is more in the book that's about the history of the Forster family. There are more stories in here about the uses of toothpicks. There's even more in this book than we have discussed here this morning. So for people who are interested, I would certainly recommend you take a look at this book, The Toothpick, Technology and Culture, by our guest Henry Petrosky. It's published by Knopf. And a number of his other books are certainly still in print in paper. You might find his book on the pencil interesting. That's also available in a paperback from Knopf. Our guest Henry Petrosky is professor of civil engineering and professor of history at Duke University. And Professor Petrosky, thanks very much.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.